Oh, right. Right, 4 seconds in. Okay, so, right, this is the latest episode of the Pasta Gang podcast. I should have actually checked how many episodes I have already, but I think it's like 5 or 6, something like that. I think there was one just went up recently. I haven't watched it. But I'm Daniel, and I'm part of Pasta Gang, but a kind of fairly peripheral member. But I do absolutely love the ethos, and you are, do you want to introduce yourself, Alex?
I'm Alex, I'm also a peripheral member of Pasta Gang, but also love the ethos, and I'm super interested in where it's going. Live coding has sort of gradually shifted towards more professional performances, at least in how it's viewed on TikTok and Instagram. So it's nice to have this kind of counter movement of sort of celebrating from scratch live coding and sort of community focus and things like that.
No, that's really interesting, because we kind of saw that we were earlier this year in the lead up to the EraCamp thing. We saw that in person, that kind of contrast of performer styles, with performers coming across from the US who, I don't think it's applied to everyone, but like certainly one or two people, they have the like the spirit, in-person spirit of like, hey, I'm a cool coder, but part of that kind of unseen is this laser focus on like putting a professional show on that. I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating a bit there, but like, you know, when you set up a screen projection on a show and it's just like going off the edges, it's slightly at an angle, it's like the keystoning's up. Well, I mean, that's for me, that's like, oh, I see what's going on. There's some bright shapes. Yeah, that's all good. But they were like going into their computer and then like redoing the screen inside using OBS or something. Like perfectly line it up with the screen, and so it looked, I'm not criticizing that, because that looks cool, and like, and I don't want to disrespect people who have that attention to detail, but I really appreciate what you're saying, that it's good to push back against that as well. And I think that is a big part of Pasta Gang, like Bad Code Only, which is probably the most infamous. It's good to have that kind of counterpoint there, you know, because like people are doing really amazing stuff all the time, and it's like it's so in danger. Someone does something really cool, and everyone's like, "Oh, that's really cool," and then you end up into this kind of escalation of like, "Oh no, it's got to be really good," and we're constantly having to push back against that at the events that I see, because people just put it on themselves, you know? So you've got to constantly cultivate them.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm totally into having projections at a jaunty angle and sort of having that sort of get across the fact that actually projecting code is super central, but it's also not that important, because it's like a gesture of openness, and it doesn't mean that you have to have this thing which everyone's staring at, and it's nice to be able to read it, but also to feel like it's not actually important to read it. I've always kind of struggled between the accessibility of projection. Like there was a really great live coder, Annie, who was profoundly deaf, who joined the community and still drops in a few now and then. He was like super appreciative of the live coded projection, because it meant he could access the music more. But always sort of explored alternatives, like over projecting, having two people performing together and just projecting one on top of the other so that it's visible but also kind of difficult to read. And sort of explored that kind of thing, but kind of settled back on, in general, just projecting it, but then exploring ways of not having it too central. Like just now, I did a nice collaboration with two drummers, BC Manjanath and Matt Davis, and didn't know how to project. I wanted to project because it's kind of would be weird, I think, to just be sat there with my staring at my laptop next to these very animated drummers, but also didn't want to have a big rectangular screen overpowering everything because it's a bit like having a mute television in a pub.
Yeah.
With the football on, even if you don't like football, you still find yourself staring at it.
So
we wanted to try things like projecting on the floor, or projecting something small behind me. In the end, we kind of had a compromise with what was available in the sound check time we had available. I think the kind of ideal for me is having projections everywhere, because then they're somehow not the focus. So explore with having projections on every wall, rather than the kind of PowerPoint style one behind the performer.
That's really interesting.
Less directional, but there's no kind of perfect. You have to kind of accept there's no perfect solution to this one and just keep experimenting, I think.
Yeah, it's about just hovering, or kind of, there's a term they use in psychology of shimmering, where you kind of like, you kind of flutter a little bit and you kind of go one way a bit and the other way a bit, kind of float about, and you try one thing and you try not to go too far in any one direction. And I think that's what it's all about, just trying to find balance. And I'd never really thought of it that way before. You don't want, I mean, I have seen that where people kind of like get like they're just staring at the code, or you get that kind of effect where everyone's stood around in a, watching the screen. So we up sometimes and just be like, "Hey, everyone, come over here!" Like, you know, Lou's really good at like just kind of being like, "Everyone, come and be on the screen." Usually by the air in the boat, closes the loop a little bit.
I think it does happen more when people are less familiar with live coding, and by the end of the evening that kind of reverence is broken down, and people are less distracted by the code and getting into the music more.
I think
another alternative is to not project, but to just sit in the middle of the audience. I think that can work really well. I've enjoyed doing that before, where people just can look over your shoulder if they're curious, don't feel like they have a screen between you and them, like the back of the laptop screen. But
I've done that where and not being able
with Pasta Gang, it's kind of a natural thing. Like if there's lots of people, and the same with sort of Pasta Gang's historical precursor, Power Books Unplugged, they were all about sitting in the room, and then there's just no need to project because you can just look at the performer next to you and you kind of break down the difference between the audience and the performer then.
I've tried it. This depends on mood for me and for other people, but sometimes when you're performing, you're kind of like late, you're like really like locked in a kind of tunnel vision with it. But other times it can be really nice to have a little bit of a chat with the people around you, or even the actual audience themselves, and make it a kind of like almost like a kind of like interactive kind of thing. That can be really fun, and also a really good way of like, if you're kind of getting a bit locked up and kind of like you're getting a bit stuck on it, it's not really kind of flowing for you, it can be really nice to like have a little chat with someone about what you're doing or something in the middle of it. I mean, it doesn't work for every performance, but like that can be a fun thing to do. But I mean, I have seen it the other way around.
Yeah, I guess.
uninvited and it's kind of stressed people out, but yeah.
Yeah, but I guess sort of stepping back a bit, it's kind of nice as an organiser to kind of tweak these conditions so that you're kind of changing things up a bit, placing performers in a different place in the room, or changing how the projections work. Or I think it's a kind of fun privilege to have to be able to play with the parameters of the event a bit, just to set things up where you don't know what's going to happen as an organiser, as well as improvising live code. You're kind of setting up different conditions and seeing what happens.
That is one of the most exciting things of seeing what people add to something, what they create, which different ways, and creating that space for things to happen and kind of unfold. Like you say, you're just kind of setting the parameters.
It's kind of and that's kind of where Algorave has tended towards these polished performances. It's even though in a sense the music has got better and the audience has really enjoyed it, it's felt kind of less rewarding, or at least the motivation to organise things. Like, I just remember the first, or one of the first, Algraves at Corsica Studios, where we had two rooms, they both really went off, all the music was really great, and it just felt wonderful, but at the same time, felt less motivated to do it again, because that had been successful then. It kind of worked out how Algrave can actually work and meet its aims, but then the kind of motivation to organise them dropped off because there's less surprises, because once you've succeeded in doing something, or at least for me, I find it less interesting to just reproduce that. And it's happened a few times, like with the Headphone Festival, it's called Placard, something that started in Paris, but where in London we made this event where it was just like a full day of performances, one every 20 minutes, with automatic switching between mixes, so that it was a projection telling people where to set up. So it was like a kind of automated festival, really, and it went really, really well. It was just fantastic, and we did the same the next year. And it was just less exciting because we kind of knew what was going to happen then.
I think Lucy used
it. It's a bit more like going through the motions.
Yeah, there's no jeopardy. I think that's how Lucy described it recently.
Yeah.
Our friend Heavy Lifting, for those who don't know, jeopardy, like, there's no kind of risk I guess there's one other aspect of that is it provides a handy excuse when everyone's like, this is total chaos, and you're like, don't worry, we're just ensuring jeopardy and enough risk, and it's like it kind of gives you an excuse not to like overproduce things, you know. I agree that I think that's one of the reasons why it would be hard for me to... I don't know if I ever would be able to, but if I thought about going into software engineering, it's... success is boring, and if you're a professional software developer, not always, but often, you've got to do stuff, like, very methodically, lots of testing, lots of kind of, like, production, continuous integration stuff and everything, and... I would just be like, oh god, this is so boring, you know. Even though there might be interesting technical elements, I'm just not that kind of person, you know. But I wanted to just we're about nearly 15 minutes in, so I've got some notes that some thoughts that I've been thinking about, because there was a couple of things that I wanted to ask you about, Alex. So As a kind of context, so you've got history. You've been involved in live coding and algorithm for a long time, I think it's safe to say. I don't want to big you up too much, because I don't know if that would make you uncomfortable, but you've certainly been someone who's really been part of it, you know. Does it go back to, like, was it Slub, the name of your like laptop collab thing? And then there's the whole algorithm concept, then there's a whole tidal cycles development, and that kind of lineage does flow through even right up to Strudel. Obviously is a very popular platform these days, and that's strongly drawn from that, the mini notation syntax, and it's changed about a bit, the syntax, but it's supposed to be a web port of Tidal, really, isn't it? So I wanted to ask you, I've got one kind of main question about that, but I also I wanted to explore that a little bit, because I think it's an interesting history. But my main question, if you can still hear me because my screen keeps on flickering and out, is actually, so as we know, there are like probably hundreds, if not thousands, of like different live coding languages, creative computing projects, audio stuff, visual stuff. Like, there's like nearly everyone, a lot of people get drawn into that temptation to kind of create something, which is awesome, and I totally encourage people to do that. But out of that sea of like stuff, there's actually a few things that end up becoming widely used. And as someone who's been gone down that rabbit hole myself of creating something that I use, it dawned on me like what a huge amount of work it would take to spread the word about something, do the workshops, do the presentations, attend the conferences and that. So my question to you, and like, I'm interested to hear what you say about this, is like, what drives someone, as you have done, to go through that years-long process of really like buckling down and pushing through? You know, where does that come from? Or maybe it didn't feel like that. I don't know. Right, I'm going to leave it to you because I'm not talking now.
Yeah, I think we've got a bit of a latency, but as long as we're taking turns, it's fine. So, I guess it wasn't the aim to have a huge user base ever. And so all the workshops and things that I've done, out of the pleasure of doing it. The first workshop was in Barcelona, and that was probably a year or so, a good few years maybe, after I started working on what became Tidal. So it was definitely a tool that I made just for myself and the people I was collaborating with. Uploading in the spirit of open source, but not adding any documentation or something. There's no point when it's changing all the time, and that I didn't need documentation for what I was writing for myself. So it's just like making this kind of with all the lots of motivations for making something for that was more immediate and could actually fulfill this dream of being able to write code from scratch to make something while collaborating with percussionists and things. I think part of the success is down to just being grounded in practice in that way. Making something for me when I don't have any background in music, education or anything like that. So being able to make something, but also at the same time having the privilege of being on research degrees, so having lots of time and resources to read lots of influential texts like from Bernard Bell and Laurie Spiegel, kind of taking these alternative views of pattern that let me make a system which could really work in an improvisational context rather than the usual kind of linear, kind of pencil tool driven composition you see in contemporary doors in jumble. But then there was a decision where I thought, right, okay, now I want to support other people in exploring this and focus away from, I realised I'm not going to become a mainstream musician. It's not going to be how I support myself. Take this more precarious role where I'm really motivated to make the system for other people to use. And for that, it was important to not put my name on Tidal, create its own domain, give the community agency in defining what it was, and not put myself forward as the kind of person driving it, but allow the community to drive it itself, I suppose. I think that was super important.
Yeah. Which is a very Pastigan thing. I mean, sorry, I'm sorry.
Sorry, we will interrupt each other. Just have to. I think there's probably about 5 seconds or something, isn't there, the latency?
Yeah.
Carry on.
So I was just saying, like, that's a very Pastigan thing to do. I was really lucky to receive a pass for the ADC Audio Developers Conference in Bristol, I think it is, but just an online thing. So this is a bit of a humble brag, but I was able to like see Lou's presentation last night of the keynote at that, and the third part of that was all about the talk itself is how many heads do you need, and it's about moving from one head, I think I'm a massive genius, to actually I'm not, and I'm just like you know, and actually like working with other people is where it's at, you know, collaborating. And obviously Pastigan then takes it to the extreme of like of just kind of like being so like radically open. But again, it's that underlying ethos of like, we're not going to make this about one person, and we're going to listen to many voices. Because like something that has been dawning on me, maybe this year, maybe earlier, is like, like, no disrespect to anyone, but I don't think humans are actually that clever. I think, and I include myself in this, I'm sure, we're not that bright. We're pretty pathetic, useless animals, really, so that sounds really negative, but hear me out. But like, what our superpower is collaborating and learning from each other. That is where we're just like, and if you think about anything, I mean, this is just an extension of the whole the Brian Eno thing of like, there's no such thing as genius, there's senius. It takes a collection, a group, a collaboration, a scene of people to make anything happen. And that is so true, because not one person can have all the ideas.
Yeah.
You need different perspectives, different ideas, different input from people. Sorry, I'm just going on a massive rant. Yeah. I think it's
true. Humans are, humans are really thick, I think, and I think that's kind of amazing that we achieve what we do, really, because we're not even evolved to read and write. That's just entirely something that we've taught ourselves to do. I guess our brains have the capacity to do that, to kind of read paths that we're walking down, and somehow through our education systems we've managed to kind of side channel those cognitive resources to read and write. And now with live coding, we're kind of taking that and mixing it with the ability, I don't know, kind of taking something like this technology of writing and reading, which has been so revolutionary with the printing press and things like that, and tried to find an alternative by having this version of text which is really plastic, and for the moment, and is maybe closer to speech, even though we use a keyboard to work with it. And yeah, it's just such a kind of strange thing to imagine. I mean, in the early days of live coding, we were imagining these performances which we just weren't able to do and weren't sure if it was even possible to do.
Because
we didn't have the languages and the practices that actually turned it into reality. So we were kind of talking about doing from scratch performances way before, at least for me, way before we actually managed to achieve that reality.
Wow.
I found an advert for an event we were organising where we said something about writing music with, creating music from Perl scripts, Perl being a very popular language at the time. Now quite obscure, I think. And saying some of these scripts would be written live. And we'd written that, but we weren't calling it live coding. We weren't calling it live programming yet. We weren't calling it anything, and we weren't even doing it. We just saw it as kind of something that we might want to
do. That's really interesting. I mean, I've been aware of this concept of from scratch since probably, you know, the beginning of my involvement in live coding, which started around like 2015. I do know the exact date actually, but like, but it took me, it wasn't until September this year that I did a from scratch performance that I felt like comfortable with, in the sense that like I wasn't like I just felt like it was flowing a bit, and I felt like, I'm not going to say like good or bad or like, let, you know, it just, it was a good process. And that's, you know, and, but like, I was lucky enough to be involved in the, as you were, the Summer Xcode Bootcamp in Peckham this year. And they've just taken this like idea of from scratch and run with it. Not everyone, everyone's got, you know, different things they want to get from it, but two or three of them are like just doing this amazing from scratch stuff, and you're like, I wonder if they would do that if they knew how hard it was.
Yeah, it's super hard. I think,
like, they've got no fear, you know.
Yeah, it's something I wanted to do since early on, because I was working with improvising percussionist, who was really pushing me to do from scratch, but it just wasn't really possible in the this feedback.pl Perl environment I was making, and that's what kind of pushed me into making Tidor, really.
So that's a kind of core part of it, was because I often think that like things are created in a context, and that always carries with them, you know, like, you know, it's the ethos behind something is shapes it, you know. I know that sounds a bit obvious saying it like that, but like, it's really interesting to hear that the improvisation was a core thing, because maybe that answers my question of like, why did it become this massive thing? Because it's designed to leap into and just like start pinging stuff off, you know. So that's really interesting to hear that. And then I guess following on from that is that then
not only has it become a community title cycles, a bigger thing, and the live coding scene itself has become this huge international thing with conferences and stuff, but then also, as we talked about earlier, we've got things like Strudel, which have come out of title cycles and given it a whole new lease of life. And not that it wasn't alive already, but you know, another kind of realm. And yeah, I wanted to hear your thoughts on that, and is, you know, what does that feel like? Yeah.
Yeah, I guess my perspective is probably different from most perspectives. I kind of don't really see any difference between Strudel and Tidal, apart from there's a lot more people involved. I guess for me it's nice because it's like a chance to kind of start again in a way, because obviously it's a completely new code base. But the kind of core representation of pattern is very much the same. A nice thing about it for me is that I think I'm like the third person in the list of contributors now, because Felix and Jade have contributed so much to Strudel. But I still feel that it's part of the same project, and it's nice how we're kind of moving towards this idea of the Uzu language as being not, so we don't say anymore that Strudel is a port of Tidal, but rather that Tidal and Strudel are Uzu Texas languages. So we've got this kind of umbrella. And there's over a dozen Uzu languages in use and development, I think, now, including ones embedded in Strudel, like the Mondo notation, which is pushing it forward.
I want to try that Mondo notation. That looks really cool.
Yeah, me too. I haven't had time, but over the next 2 months, I'm intending to get stuck into the Mondos.
Well, I mean, that's really great to hear, though, that you see it as kind of one and the same thing, because that's like success, right? It's like, you know, it's... I've kind of, like, lost my thread there. Sorry.
Yeah, I guess it's, like community-owned now. It's not centred around any one person. It's a community-owned project.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think there's always trade-offs, but, like, I was using Strudel at a workshop on Monday, and I was able to give a 30-minute workshop. It was supposed to be 45, which was already pretty short, down to 30 minutes. But I was able to just go to this website, here's a line of code, there's a beat, here's another line of code, there's a melody, here's another line of code, you know. And I mean, I wasn't dictating to them, I was asking them to type out these lines of code, you know. And so then they were like, you know, mind blown, because like, but, you know, within 20 minutes, they've typed out on their computer and it's going ping, ping, ping. And like, they're just getting that dopamine hit of like, I did a thing, whoa. And like, obviously you can't go through like everything, you know, there were some core concepts in there, like the cycle and that, you know, and stuff. But like, it was so great to be able to give people that kind of like 0 to 100 or whatever the millennials would say is like, you know, and then give them that launch pad to then go into the docs and the tutorials and explore more. And we're hopefully going to do more of those. But that was a really satisfying experience to have that. You know, open a browser, just jump in, and we can just make some music. And just connecting those dots, like, whoa, going from, like, what is this code stuff to, wait, oh, yeah, this is really, you know, happening kind of thing. So that was really satisfying, and I think that's
a huge
appeal of it.
Yeah, absolutely. It was really... I remember doing these workshops with eight-year-olds in schools, bringing some Raspberry Pis in. We called it an algorithmic drumming circle because we had eight kids at a time in a circle, making beats together, and they could just jump in and get stuck in and make music. Record a performance with each other within an hour. Again, they were supposed to be 10-year-olds, but they turned out to be eight-year-olds. but yeah, they had to teach them how to use a keyboard. But because I had Raspberry Pis, didn't have to install something. But I really don't miss the kind of hour or maybe 2 hour long installation parts of the workshops that we had to do with Tidal. I think there are differences, talking over the latency thing.
But, like, I would see it more like you've got that the OG Tidal Cycles people who are like, you aren't going to take me from my Tidal. and because it's so, like, good in a performance environment, the notation's more minimal and that. But I can see it as, like, people can use Strudel as a gateway jug or, like, a jam session or, like, a web-based tool. But then you can go into, I'm going to install Tidal. Because once you've done it once, it's like you're there. Do you know what I mean? You've got, you know, you don't have to do that every time. So I think it's like, it's not a like one or the other. It's like a kind of like an additional thing. Like you put, you know, like they're bigger than the sum of the parts kind of thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think, and I think they are coming together as well, like with projects like Weft that have Strudel on the back end, but Tidal, Tidal syntax on the front end, and Strudel used to have a Haskell Tidal mode as well. It's that Felix made and this kind of thing. And there's a nice feature, pull request with a block-based evaluation, which I think is the biggest user interface difference between Strudel and Tidal. And the reason why Tidal does work a bit better for improvisation, I think, is that you have to evaluate the whole file in Strudel, whereas with Tidal it can be a bit more playful and just have lots of different bits that you switch on and off. You can do that with Strudel, but it's just a little bit more awkward in my experience, but probably depends on what you're used to some extent.
Yeah.
And I think longer term, with the UZU language, I think things will merge together into more of a whole. But while, like you say, still embracing this whole, it's bigger than the sum of the parts thing, where things can, these different dialects can have differences. But we will have ways, I think, of understanding what those differences are and kind of celebrating them. Like, we're going to have, I think, different tests which kind of say whether this feature, what this feature is, and then we can see how to implement it in these different implementations. But then you don't have to have that feature if you don't want it in the system that you're working with.
So it's quite a technical discussion,
but I think actually it's really important to not focus on a single implementation of something and see how you can have an open, free open source ecosystem where these differences are celebrated and get away from the normal GitHub model of there being a tree-like structure with like the implementation and then forks of it, which merge back in, but still kind of have that hierarchy built into it, but more have this
network,
sort of
ecosystem.
Yeah, exactly, kind of an ecosystem rather than this top-down tree.
No, that's really,
I think that's in really general. Just to quickly say that the model of change management in software that we've adopted, which is based on this tree, is really privileges linear development and the idea of getting towards this sort of idealistic endpoint. This kind of
right.
Like a lot of problems in society, it's like this problem of having this idea of linear progress towards a goal, rather than looking at what you've done in the past and thinking, oh, maybe I should return to that. Yeah. Or having this ecosystem, I think, will be interesting when we get there.
Yeah, no, that sounds really exciting. So I've got a couple more questions that I wanted to ask you about. So
should we try and keep this to an hour?
Yeah, sure. I think we can achieve that, definitely. So our friend Lucy Cheeseman, who's known as Heavy Lifting, is a really vibrant person within the scene who really kind of like helps other people make things happen and brings great energy to things. So I wanted to ask you about something that Lucy said to me once, because I was talking about, you know, when you've got someone who's like shy or kind of underconfident and you want to kind of draw something out from them, or you just want to make it feel like they have the permission to go forward or to try something. I've always found that really difficult, because you don't want to like push people and be like, come on, or like, come on. But you also don't want to neglect them completely and be like, you'll figure it out. There's got to be some kind of balance there. But what something Lucy said to me once, that she felt that you were really good at like getting that balance right and drawing things out for people. So I don't know if you have any insight into how you're able to like pull off this magic trick, but I'd love to hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, I don't think I have loads to say about that. I guess it is kind of just being aware of if there's a quiet person in the corner, just checking in with them, and also making it clear that it's okay for them to stay in the corner if they want, I suppose. I don't really know. I guess it's just trying to be... Yeah, I guess I'm not really sure what exactly Lucy is referring to in terms of things that happened. Or, that she said it. But,
isn't it?
Yeah.
I actually find that really fascinating, of someone's perception from the outside. I did a really scrappy performance where I felt like everything was on fire the whole time, and I barely kind of like, you know, it wasn't even about, you know, trying to do anything in particular, just to like make things happen. And then afterwards someone was like, oh, that was really polished. And I was just like, what?
Yeah.
It's insane. But I took that as like a message to me of like, people have different perceptions to, you know, and so things can look very different from the outside, and I think you have to respect that. I was kind of more concerned that it sounded polished than if it sounded scrappy. But that's just an example of like how like, yeah, you can not be aware of something yourself, and then others bring this perspective to you, and you're like, oh my god, like I had no idea. But it's positive. I guess what I'll have to do is like observe you teaching students and
yeah,
things. I guess it's about being gentle and creating the space, and maybe just like nudging a little bit in a kind of, not a passive aggressive way, but in a kind of like, well, you know, I think you can do it, you know, feel free to prove me wrong kind of thing. I don't know.
Just giving people time. People time to ask the question, even if that's on their mind, even if it takes them a while, or
yeah,
Yeah, it's a tricky one.
Yeah.
I think the kind of distance between a performer and an audience is a really interesting topic, though, which I haven't got my head around. I did a performance with two drummers I mentioned earlier, and I kind of knew at the time that it was a success, but I still felt terrible about it because there was so much that I wanted to do, which I didn't feel able to do. I made stupid mistakes, which I knew the audience wouldn't necessarily pick up on. And I think there is a case where it's not just about the audience when you're performing, it's about you. Like, and this comes back to our previous discussion, you can like focus entirely on the audience and make there's not going to be any surprises, that things are just going to be beautifully sculpted, the kind of DJ approach, and yeah, again, totally respect DJs, they do great things in creating amazing experiences for people, but yeah, when you're it's a bit selfish in a way to focus on yourself and how you feel in terms of what you get out of the performance. And for me, those surprises are really key. When something surprising works, you get an idea you didn't think of, you learn something new about the system that you use, you're using or you made. That's where the meaning is for me. When I do a performance where I make stupid mistakes, don't quite get where I want to, I think it's okay to feel bad about that, even if.
It's a struggle, isn't it? It's a struggle. I mean, part of me feels that definition of a performer is someone who keeps very quiet about all the massive mistakes they just made. It's kind of like. It's because, like, someone actually said that to me. I was like, I did a performance where I was like, oh my god, that was so terrible. And I don't know, I think it might have been V. Buckingham, who's a very kind of direct and to the point person. And they were like, you literally always say that. But I did, you know, it's like. You know, it's just like, yeah, I need to not do that. And I've, like, I've done, that's over, like, 20 years of attempting to perform, and I've learned that lesson over and over and over again. But I still am like, ah, that was terrible. Like, not in a really negative way. You're so focused on your kind of end of this trumpet kind of thing that, like, you know, you're just completely zoned in to what an error is, and you forget that 99% of it was either happy accidents, which, like you say, are magical moments, or like just like it was fine. And so yeah, it's all about like enjoying it, I guess, as much as possible, because otherwise why do it?
I've totally done performances that I've really enjoyed as well, and that have gone really well. But then, yeah, it's funny which thing, what stops you, and also it's nice to be pushed forward by good and bad experiences, I think. And to have a bad, feel that the performance didn't work well for me as a performer, but still find it super meaningful, because it's not just about happiness, but finding reasons for doing it.
I mean, I totally agree. I would say that me personally, like, if I had a string of like really not enjoyable performances, I would lose heart and I would just stop. So I do try, and like, you know, it's not just about me, it's about it's about the audience and the collaboration and that. And this is something that, like, is so what's so good about Pasta Gang, because it's not one performer. Everyone, you know, you're going through that together, and so it completely negates that thing. But what I would say is that I think it is important that you do enjoy it, and you do kind of like get something from it as a performer, because that's going to sustain you. So even if it is, even if it feels gratuitous, like, you're like, afterwards you've got this glow, like, ooh, I did a show last night and it didn't go completely wrong. You know, fine. I mean, I embrace that. I think we can't, we often kind of, like, go too far of, like, you know, oh, I don't know, too, you know, because there's a lot of really egotistical people in the world. We push back against it, and we should. But I think you can't operate at all if you have zero ego. You do have
ego.
And, like, I fully admit that I've been involved, luckily, in a lot of events in the last 18 months. And, you know, I did it for me as much as for anyone else, because I wanted to see it.
Yeah.
I wanted to perform.
Yeah.
And I think that's valid. It's a motivation. And I'll be completely honest about that.
I think for me, I do agree.
That
I think
to try and justify me, but, like, you know, to try and encourage other people that you can do it for yourself as well, you know?
Yeah, I think as a musician, you have the privilege of making the music that you want to listen to. So it does sound egotistical to say I make the best music, but I think people should.
Everyone thinks that.
I think as a musician, that should be okay, because you're making it for yourself, and so you're making every decision based on what you want to hear next. So you should be able to get to the point.
Yeah.
And I probably have got to that point more earlier in my career than I do now. Get to the point where I really feel this is the best music, this is exactly what I want to listen to, and I'm making it.
That's great to hear.
And that's fine.
That's great to hear.
But at the same time, it's nice to push yourself out of a comfort zone and keep pushing yourself forward, put yourself in situations where it's less familiar territory, where you make mistakes and things. I also agree totally with Pastor Gang. You are in it together, and that it's a totally different thing from going solo, and I think that's true of any collaboration. It's a real motivation for me. The reason why I do collaborations is that you have people you can talk about it afterwards in a more critical way than you can with an audience member who there might be all kinds of reasons why the performance made them feel really good. Music would have been part of it, but also the whole situation. Being in an audience can be just a wonderful feeling, sort of the shared experience.
Absolutely. And I think there's this kind of almost a Jungian, sorry, going a bit hippie here, but this Jungian consciousness of, like, connection between the artist is responding emotionally to the audience and vice versa. And I think you do, they're, or if you want the modern crazy version is Morphic Fields, but either way, like, I think there is something to be said for that connection. It's a spiritual thing and an important thing. So I'm conscious that we're, like, probably coming up to an hour soon, but one thing I wanted to touch on that was follows on what we were talking about, events and things. So this is Pastor Gang, and Pastor Gang's an international organisation that I think at last count there's about 7 billion people in Pastor Gang, something like that. What's one thing that Lou touched on in their talk yesterday was that there is an element of Pastor Gang that's the in-person thing of, like, being in a room with other people doing live collaboration, and that is an angle and element, but people might not have that scene where they are in the world. So I wanted to kind of just briefly explore for the last 5 minutes, like, how can people, if you're in a small town somewhere or wherever you are, and you've got an interconnect connection, you've heard about this single Pastor Gang, you've jammed with them a couple of times, but, like, there's nothing happening around you. How can people start to build, you know, because we both live, you live in Sheffield, I live in London, and we've been both, like, incredibly lucky to have all these things popping off over a period of years, but not everyone has that. So how can people make things happen where they are?
Yeah, I guess maybe it's not possible if they're in a remote area, but hopefully they can at least find someone to jam with. Yeah, I guess in the early days there were only a couple of people in each city, and you just find one other interested person, form a band, and then connect with other people doing similar things through the internet for that creative feel.
Right.
There's a couple of online live streams. I think that's where I feel most part of an international community, apart from going to the international conference on live coding, is sort of being part of these 24-hour streams where people are just streaming performances from around the world, and yeah, it's really nice. I guess if you're in a reasonable sized town or city, you could start trying to run workshops and things, or meetups and stuff. Can be quite hard work, but also just jump on to one of the top platforms and ask for advice on doing that. I guess I have always lived in the city through my adult life, so maybe I'm not the best person to answer that. I think most big cities do have life coding scenes of some. Maybe that's not true. But a lot do, so you can have a look at the nodes on toplab.org. But
I would say it's a combination of things. Like you say, there's you can start a band, you can work with other quote unquote normal musicians. and then like you say, if there's a big enough place, you could go on to workshops and things. And I've seen this happen with the artist from Melbourne, who came to the UK this year. So she was like, "Oh, where can?" And has since found other people. They've done meetups together. Now they're doing this whole like program of events that I saw is happening next summer, I think. So that's in Melbourne, and like that's so cool. Like that someone's, and I think part of it comes down to that you just need one person who's gonna do that thing that no one else has done, and it could be like write an email or respond to this or just like fill this thing in or whatever. There's always gonna be one thing that just needs to be done to like for events to happen. And it's not actually that complicated, but as long as you've got one person who does that thing that no one else has done, as long as they're not always that person, or as long as there's like other people that will help them, but or maybe there's, that I'm saying at least one person, not just one, So I think you can be that person where you say, okay, it'll be on me to like, just do this, small thing that's going to enable other people to get involved. And as long as you're like careful with that and you don't take too much on yourself, then don't hold back from like trying to make things happen. And also asking other people about it, sharing experiences. And, I feel like this is a really lucky time for live coding from my perspective, and I hope that around the world other people would feel the same way. We're nearly at the end. Have you got any other closing remarks, anything else you'd like to say before we draw this to an end?
Yeah, I guess also wanted to celebrate second people and third people. I think the tide or cycles really started taking off when Mike Hodnick came along and just put loads of work every day. He'd make a new pattern and share it. And that's when it really started to become a community. The second wave is in that way is more important than the first.
Absolutely.
And successive waves. It's what yeah, when you look back, you kind of tend to look back at the kind of first sort of the time, but actually the where things have really happened has often been the second person coming along, or third or fourth. And the kind of community, we should be careful not to focus too much on figureheads and things. I know that you really try and do that, share the keys, yeah, and sort of make things collaborative, and that's something that we haven't done very well in Sheffield much. It has been me and Lucy for a long time organising things, and just because we do that and we're used to doing that, kind of stops other people from getting involved, and that can limit things. While looking at communities like in the Netherlands or in Barcelona, it just always seems to be loads of people taking things on and sort of sharing the load, and in London as well.
I guess
be the second person if you're not the first.
I want to kind of reaffirm that I like 100% agree, and it's not just about one person. It's that's the minimum you need, is just to have that.
Because
do not make it about one person, and don't try and control things. Like we were saying earlier, and like the Pasta Gang ethos, don't try and be like, oh, it's got to be like this, or it's got to be like this, or these are the rules. Like, let it flow, you know, and things find their path and they take on their own life. And I think that's so important.
Yeah. But I think at the same time, as an organiser, you do have the privilege and the opportunity to be opinionated about how things run. I know that's not the ethos of Pasta Gang.
Breaking up a little bit.
Yeah, I think because we're using a system, hopefully it'll record locally and people will be able to hear. I think there is something seriously wrong with my internet connection, sorry, but hopefully...
I was kind of hoping we could use Jitsi, because while we were getting connected, you can do a background where I would have looked like I was like sat on the beach by the sea, and I just thought, oh, that looks so cool. But instead, so you get you can. There is a beach.
Right, I'll close my eyes and imagine.
They haven't got so many cool backgrounds on Jitsi.
Yeah, we did have to jump into the system last minute because Jitsi wasn't happy.
No,
with
that's
my...
absolutely fine. And I've got a brick wall. Oh.
Can you lovely, yeah. Urban. Great. Well, thanks so much for this chat.
Really good, Anna. And it's been hopefully really lovely. Just a bit, you know. I think we could, in an hour you can only really briefly touch on things and that, but hopefully it's something that like sparks conversations, because we ourselves do not. I certainly don't have any definitive answers or anything, and it's more about listening as much as possible. I think it was a shame we didn't talk more about Pasta Gang, seeing as that we're gonna like just upload this to the girl. But you know, we're in Pasta Gang. We're the peripherals.
Yeah.
Talking
Pasta
from
gang,
the periphery,
Pasta gang, Pasta gang.
You know, we're coming at it from our kind of like that was really good, and I'll see you on the 26th, thank you very much, Alex. That's been amazing.
Yeah, thanks very much, Daniel. Awesome. We'll stop the recording. Yeah, Pasta gang.
Awesome.
See you. Bye.
Bye.